Hello and welcome to Film Podcast with Brian Stumpf and Joe Friend. Here you'll find some bits and bobs of Hollywood ephemera as we take a deep dive on a specific topic. I am your host, Joe Friend, award-winning screenwriter, musician, pedantic man about town, and general polymath, accompanied by my friend and cohort, a renowned independent film producer, writer, and director, Brian Stumpf. Brian, are you excited for today's podcast, or are you getting too old for this shit?
I'm getting too old for this podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Friend and Stumpf podcast.
Okay, if you haven't guessed it already, folks, we're doing Lethal Weapon. And this is going to be one of the capstones to our 80s action film series. This is our 10th official episode that we've recorded, so let's give ourselves a little X-pat on the back. All right, Brian, before we get started, you know what we need to do? We need to try to stump the stump.
I don't think we need to.
Stump the stump.
No, I don't think we need stump to. The stump. All right, but proceed with your tomfoolery.
Stump the stump. Okay, Brian, let's start off with the easiest question I can think of. One that anybody who's even seen this movie, not even half a time, would know the immediate answer to this question. What is the name of the Murtaugh's cat?
Burbank. Burbank is the name of the cat.
Get out of here, Burbank.
Nota del editor.
Editor's note. Our astute listeners will notice that we stumped Brian with this one earlier in the season. He thought it was an impossible question. Any viewer of this movie will notice that they mention the cat's name once every 15 seconds.
I don't think Burbank the cat's gonna like this.
I'll put five on the mutt.
Burbank. Okay, moving right along. How old is Roger Murtaugh turning at the beginning of the movie?
I believe he's turning 50.
He is turning 50, that is correct. And in real life, Danny Glover was actually how old 40. At the time of filming? That is right. Both he and Mel Gibson were cast into roles that were much older than they actually were at the time. Speaking of Mel Gibson, a.k.a. Riggs, Martin Riggs. What popular commercial spokesperson is on the television when Riggs wakes up naked in his trailer at the beginning of the film?
I was just too distracted by the gratuitous bare butt to even notice that. But I don't know, Lisa Gibbons or was it Penn and Teller? Who was it?
Legendary chicken huckster Frank Perdue.
That's why it pays to insist on a chicken with my name on it.
Oh, Frank Perdue. I should have known that.
Perdue done it. Speaking of Mel Gibson's butt, since you brought it up, who else was considered for this role?
Was it Burt Reynolds or was it Bryan Cranston? No, I think Bryan Cranston was too young at the time. I'm floundering on this question. Can you help me out?
Let's follow up the question real quick. Mel Gibson was considered for this other big role in another 80s blockbuster.
Oh, I know what it is. Die Hard. Bruce Willis.
That is correct. Bruce Willis was considered for the role in Lethal Weapon, and Mel Gibson was considered for the role in Die Hard. All right.
Switcheroo.
Moving on. Speaking of Lethal Weapon and Die Hard, name two of the three actors who were in both franchises.
Two of the three actors that were in, I would say Al Leong.
That's one.
Henchman, well-known henchman from Die Hard. Ronnie Cox? No. Mixing up my 80s movies. Let's see. There's others. Who are they? Lance Henriksen? Also, again, I think I'm mixing that up. But I'll just go with Ellie Young as my one and only guess.
Okay. Thankfully, we're not given partial credit, but we would have accepted Ellie Young and Ellen Trainer as well as Grandal Bush.
Oh, yeah. Who's Grandal Bush?
Grandal Bush is Agent Johnson in Die Hard, one of the special Agent Johnsons in Die Hard. And he was a beat cop in Lethal Weapon, whom Danny Glover has many conversations with. Okay, Mel Gibson once produced a biopic of this famous trio referenced in the movie.
The Three Stooges.
That is correct, Three Stooges.
You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Are you calling me crazy? You think I'm crazy? Yeah. You want to see crazy? I'll tell you.
Now, that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
What is the name of Roger Murtaugh's boat?
The Coxswain? No. I think it was the Master and Commander. No, it's the Betty. I don't know. What was that? The
Shamrock.
Shamrock.
Two more questions, and we can peter along here. What director famously turned down directing this movie?
Was it Stanley Kubrick? No.
He was filming Three Men and a Baby at the time.
Frank Oz?
Being all things being equal, that was a good guess because it was Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
And your last and final question, what is the number of Murtaugh's and Riggs' police car?
How the hell? Was it 3.14?
That's a pie in the sky answer, sir, but it was 3 William 56.
3 William 56. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm glad the podcast audience know that we are all so much smarter now. Thanks for this quiz. So appreciate it, Joe.
Thankfully, Brian, you've once again tripled down on your ineligibility to participate in any of this podcast, but we're going to keep recording anyway.
My mind is not a lethal weapon, but my fists are registered weapons.
Okay. Brian, you know, 80s action movies, we figured out that there's a lot of tropes in here. And I think one of the biggest ones, aside from starting in outer space, which is near and dear to your heart, is opening on a gritty Los Angeles at Christmas. We notice a trend here. It's Lethal Weapon. Is it a Christmas movie?
Silent night. Good question. I would say, now this is a bold comment, probably unpopular, but we've discussed how certain movies of this series have become more dated than others. And I was putting the Terminator at the top of the leaderboard. But after this movie, I'm thinking this might be the number one most dated, mostly because of certain things that we've seen done better later on. This whole Christmas thing, it was definitely done better in Die Hard. Shane Black, known for Christmas movies, at this point, he's become a cliche with how Christmas is somewhere in his movie.
Good morning, sir. Tell me, what day is it?
What day?
Goddamn Christmas!
I would have to say no. I mean, yeah. Die Hard definitely is a Christmas movie, but when you have a stripper jumping to her death at the beginning of this movie, it kind of tears it less Christmas a little bit.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you. I mean, it's on my Christmas movie list. It's one of the movies that we rewatch over the holiday season, year to year. It starts with a Christmas song. It starts with Jingle Bell Rock. There's a scene where they're selling Christmas trees. The police choir is practicing Silent Night. Elvis Presley's I'll Be Home for Christmas is on there. The Bugs Bunny Christmas special is playing. Christmas Carol is playing. And even Mr. Joshua says, it's goddamn Christmas at some point. However, aside from it being peripheral noise, it's not featured prominently.
I think I'm gonna eat the world's lousiest Christmas turkey by myself. You crazy.
I'll tell you a little secret.
What?
I'm not crazy.
But at the beginning, we get some of our more 80s trends. We get a little TNA, we get some lingerie, and we get some cocaine. And then we get a first billing of Shane Black, which is nice to see.
All those things is what Joe Frank calls a Tuesday. Shane Black famously did well as a screenwriter for this film. And we can kind of see why. He establishes some pretty sweet repartee. I think Shane Black has also aged like a fine wine, because something else I noticed about this is, I mean, the repartee is good, and there's a few funny little moments, but there are also some silly moments. I think for Shane Black's career, I think he owes his career to Mel Gibson, because if there's any one standout from this movie, I mean, we know Mel Gibson as being a different kind of person today, but this kind of cemented his role as action star. He really fills out the role of Martin Rigg well, and obviously well enough to kind of garner at least 4 sequels at this point.
We don't really get to Martin Riggs until they're introduced to his new partner. I mean, we see a quick scene of him. We see how the other half live. But there's a lot of, speaking of Shane Black and his screenwriting, there's a lot of economy in the pages itself. First, we have this gritty Los Angeles at Christmas time. We have a euphoric model in lingerie who takes a header off of a skyscraper. The actress, Jackie Swanson, she performed her own stunt for that fall. I learned that when they do falls like that, in order to keep the camera on the stunt person, or in this case, the actor, they have a matte painting of what the ground supposed to look like, with the sidewalk and the vehicles and stuff like that. And they're able to keep the camera on the person for just up to the last second until they hit the bag itself. And then you get this gruesome car smash, which is excellent filmography. Great stunt and great practical effect that they used. And then you cut to something that I think I attribute directly to the longevity of the series, which is a family scene. You know, you have Danny Glover at home getting sung Happy Birthday to in his bathtub. And then you get the first appearance of somebody whom I had a huge crush on when I was a wee lad when I first saw this movie.
Burbank?
Which is Tracy Wolf, who plays Rianne. And so you have this awesome family dynamic.
So you're going to say the cat.
And again, economy of screenwriting. And I think that pays off throughout the rest of the series. You're able to tap into this family dynamic, as well as how Martin Riggs gets incorporated into the family. But we cut to Martin Riggs, who's naked in a trailer, smoking a cigarette on Dockweiler Beach.
I gotta point out that there is a continuity there with the two introductions to the, I guess, two primary protagonists of the film. Both are stripped naked naked at their first introduction, their first appearance on the screen. Both are completely naked.
The proscenium, as the characters enter the proscenium, they are newly born.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good way to describe it. Yeah, I thought it was kind of like odd and bizarre how the family, the kids, the wife all come in as basically Murtaugh's just laying naked in his bathtub and they're singing and kissing him. And it's just like, I don't know. I think if I were having a birthday, I'd prefer that moment to be a little bit more private.
Again, this is a family. He's 50. He's got three soon-to-be grown children and a wife of a long time, and probably a single bathroom, which will later get destroyed in later part of the series. So I think it's just this, they're setting up good family dynamic. And if you look at other 80s tropes where they set up good family dynamic, or even mid-70s, late-70s,
yeah,
you got Jaws, you got Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and you got these movies that really double down on some family stuff, which I think we're missing. I think that's sorely missing. And as we covered in the Aliens podcast, we were talking about how the whole first half of the action film had no action. I think a lot of these movies nowadays just don't take the time to build that dynamic. I think the audience has a different level of expectation from these movies, and they just kind of throw flashing lights and explosions at simpletons. And I want to get back to this era of excellent setup of the characters. So that to me is an 80s staple.
Hello, baby.
Hi, honey.
I want you to meet...
I'd like you to meet Daddy's partner.
Martin Riggs.
Hi, how are you?
This is my wife, Trish. My new partner, Martin Riggs. Martin's going to join us for dinner.
Okay with you?
What's for dinner?
Yeah, definitely the whole family aspect. And also, screenwriters, listen closely, because what Shane Black does that actually is pretty sweet is juxtaposition. So we just saw Murtaugh with his whole loving, adoring family. And then we cut to Riggs, and he's just alone. He has a dog that just kind of like comes loping in from the beach. And, you know, he's just sit there with, he's got a cigarette in his mouth. He sits up, perches himself, legs spread in front of the dog. I'm not sure if the dog really appreciated that or not, but that's what he does for his dog in the morning. And then the whole gratuitous butt shot, you're kind of wondering why this scene even exists, because all it does is establish that he's like that Riggs is a man who grimaces when he takes his morning piss, and he smokes and drinks as he takes a piss. I guess we're also meant to realize that he's totally alone. I mean, we just saw Murtaugh with a loving, enduring family. Now we see Riggs just kind of like going about his morning, and he's even stripped bare of his clothes and everything. He's got nothing.
As much as you want to make this podcast specifically about naked men, I'm going to steer us away from that. So we get to the crime. We get the Vietnam buddy is mentioned offhandedly. Good screenwriting. It's also another trope. Then we get our first very humorous line. Murtaugh shows up to the crime scene. He's like, hey, what do we got? And the guy's like, we got a hooker. And the lady's like, oh, she's real funny. Roger Murtaugh caps it off with all
dressed up and no one to blow.
And then we cut to again, cocaine and beer. And it's like 8 a.m. in the morning. And here we have Martin Riggs undercover at the tree stand. We get to learn a little bit more about him. When we see the henchmen for the first time, they were interesting enough that I wanted to look up who they were. Turns out that one of them is the father of the lead singer from Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's Anthony Kiedis' father.
Sweet name for that guy.
What's that?
Do you remember his name?
Who's
the father of Anthony Kiedis?
No, I didn't go that far.
Blackie, damn it.
Drug dealer number three.
I do want to point out that this is the most violent shootout at a Christmas tree farm ever filmed. I don't think that's a popular venue for bullets and fisticuffs.
Yeah.
But here you have it.
But we get to learn that Martin Riggs is a gunslinger. You know, he does his fancy roll across the ground, which I think we see at least 9 more times throughout the series.
It's kind of superfluous.
Kind of a badass. He's a little reckless, but then we find out that maybe that recklessness is backed up by actual swagger. He can talk the talk and actually walk the walk. And then we find out that Riggs is suicidal. And this, you know, this gets back to something you said earlier. Does this movie age well? I don't think it does, because I think it has trouble figuring out what it is. That whole trope of, oh, he's a suicidal cop, let's put him over here and blah, blah, blah. It's like, that shit just, you know, that wouldn't happen. It wouldn't be so well known that you have this renegade suicidal cop. And I just think that was a reach. It would have been better handled in the periphery as opposed to up front.
Actually, Mary Ellen Trainer, who was all over the 80s movies, being the wife of Robert Zemeckis, I remember her a lot during the 80s. And yeah, we get her kind of having a very reasonable conversation with the chief of police, pointing out that he's pretty reckless and he's going to get people killed. And the chief of police is like, hey, whatever.
What does he do to dismiss her?
I think he says, excuse me, this is men's only. Can you give me a second?
Because he walks into the men's room. And I used to think that was like a very sexist thing. But then I noticed something about her. She's a pointer. Like the whole time she's talking to him, she's literally like pointing at his chest or pointing at his face. I would have been like, fuck off anyway, you know, like, get your fucking hand out of my face. So I'm not mad at him anymore for dismissing her by going to the bathroom. She should stop pointing in his face.
He is a chauvinist dick. That's very clear. Yeah, she has a very valid and solid point. He just says, he's tough, and that's it. And true enough, I mean, he does tend to escalate situations in a dangerous way, and it's like, well, okay, well, this is pretty shaky ground for establishing that Martin Riggs has to be in this particular role. So be it. It turns out he's reckless, and that's fun to watch.
So be it. So we got our setup. We got the family juxtaposition. We have our opening. We have the crime, which at first I thought wasn't a crime, but then they later tell you that she was poisoned and would have died anyway, which then makes it a crime. And you have your protagonists, plural, and your ephemeral antagonist group. I don't think there's a singular one. I don't think General was strong enough to be his own antagonist, and Mr. Joshua just ends up being the ultimate bad guy. So we got great setup here. And then we need to get to our inciting incident, Brian. What is it?
Yeah, I mean, we've established that these are the main protagonists. The main antagonist, I guess, would be Mr. Joshua.
Nope, disagree.
I mean, he's not the genius behind it all. He is the primary conflict to Riggs. You can disagree if you want. They both kind of serve the same purpose in Vietnam. They both are special forces. He's like the other side of the coin from Riggs. In that respect, maybe he's one of the main antagonists. It's interesting to think back that Gary Busey was considered like someone that would be considered intimidating. That whole opening, the introduction of him, I think is a little bit wonky and dated. This one guy, he's actually awesome. I forget his name, but Ed O'Ross as Mr. Mendez. He comes in, and he's already kind of shaky and twitchy, and there's no explanation why. He just comes in that way. And then he just is simply introduced to Mr. Joshua. He just leads him to the main bad guy, I guess, if Mr. Ming, you're going to say, McAllister. But it's interesting, though. I mean, Mr. Mendez is just, he talks to Mr. McAllister like, who's this psycho talking to Mr. Joshua? And he's done nothing. He's just led him to McAllister, and that's it. And all of a sudden, he's just labeled Mr. Joshua a psycho. And then, of course, that whole lighter moment, which I guess proves he's a tough guy, but I don't know.
I thought that was useless exposition, because the general's like, do you smoke? He's like shouting it. Like, it's like,
what the hell has that got to do with anything? Do I smoke? Do you smoke?
How do we get from 0 to 90? So I thought the general's kind of like a weak bad guy, but I wouldn't label Mr. Joshua as the main antagonist, because I think the antagonist is more just shadow company. Like the whole ephemeral idea of this, you know, Air America group of ex-Vietnam veterans who then turned into mercenaries, who then turned into a cabal of drug import, export, money laundering of heroin. And you're right. Then we get to Huntsacker.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And also, what's the inciting incident you were saying?
Well, the inciting incident is the conversation with Huntsacker. You get a sniff at it. You could go back and say the crime, the woman taking a dive off of the balcony, could be the inciting incident. But the inciting incident is actually Michael Huntsacker in the lobby of the bank where he works, fully screaming that you need to go kill this person who killed my daughter.
Oh, yeah.
In a crowded lobby. Was it ever okay to shout that?
To a cop.
Yeah, to a cop in the middle of the day.
Mike, I'm a police officer.
I don't give a shit. You're a police officer, Roger. I know you're a fucking police officer. Kill them! Just kill them!
Mike Huntsacker is definitely a consort hairspray man, like other sensitive men of the 80s, like that guy who cried in bed because he didn't have a woman with him, apparently.
Last night, I cried in bed. So how's that?
Was that me?
No, that's just your life. Okay.
So, inciting incident. I agree with that. That's the inciting incident.
Yeah. So then we get some good lines. We get another useless scene that doubles down on Riggs' psychopathy, which is a possible jumper. They get in the car. Riggs is like so psyched. If you look at his face at that moment, he's just like ready to rock. And then you have that jumper scene. I just don't like that jumper guy. There's something about him.
He's got quite a dramatic speaking voice. He's pretty hysterical. I mean, obviously it would be if you're about ready to jump. So that's convincing enough, but...
He's got one level. That's it.
Leave me alone! Please leave me alone! Leave me alone!
Why are you doing this?
None of your goddamn business!
Fair enough.
There's no nuance.
There's no dimmer switch.
It's dynamic to him. But, you know, these are character actors that are just bouncing off our main characters. You get a great line here. These types of lines are just peppered throughout the movie, so they're too numerous to list. Danny Glover goes, don't worry, I was driving before you were itching your daddy's pants. That always gets me. And then the other character. Just real quick. Name me a character in the movie that's not an actual person.
That's not a person? Well, there's Burbank the Cat. Is that what you're asking?
It's definitely a featured character. Should have gotten top billing, and it's not a person.
That's thing that they land on when they jump?
It's the saxophone, man. That saxophone.
Oh, you mean the score?
Yeah, just the sax flourishes throughout the movie, or it should be its own character.
Sax, and also Eric Clapton playing guitar. The combination of those two riffing, that's the sound of 80s to me. About the jumper scene, Shane Black does a couple things that are pretty common in his screenwriting, and one thing is subverting expectation. You expect Riggs to be totally there to save this jumper and to prevent him from jumping. No, actually, he's like, let's go, here we go. He handcuffs him to the jumper, and then they jump right off, which totally probably took everyone by surprise the first time they saw that. So I just want to take a quick moment to screenwriters to point out probably another reason why Shane Black got, well, I know it's a reason why Shane Black got chosen for this screenplay. And I read in the trivia that he had one line that everyone went crazy reading it. The line was, there was a car chase, and he says that when they crashed, the cars trade paint. Economic, to the point, badass.
We've talked about Shane Black before because we covered Predator, in which he was an actor. But let's look at some of Shane Black's writing credits. He's got all the Lethal Weapons. He did The Last Boy Scout. It was all right. Last Action Hero, which was actually pretty cool. The Long Kiss Goodnight, which is a good movie. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. It's an awesome movie.
Yeah, one of my favorites. That's where he came into his prime.
Yeah, like just beginning to end, that movie is just amazing because it's like this film noir, detective noir, LA movie set in a modern thing with two smart asses. Great movie. He did an Iron Man.
Yeah.
It's so it's lots of credits, lots of
three
excellent credits. And he had some directing gigs as well. He directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, The Nice Guys. Lots of stuff to say about Shane, particularly that I'm jealous of his career and wish I was him on occasion.
I think we can point out that this might be the break into the second act. I feel like that jumper scene where they land and then Murtaugh says, come with me. He just knows there's an empty building nearby. And he's like, Riggs has to follow him to this empty building. Hugely dramatic scene. And Riggs proves that he is suicidal because he's got the crazy eyes and he's willing to put a gun to his head.
Okay, so you're right. So act two starts. You know, we're going to go roll through act two, get to the midpoint, and then get to the second half of act two. And that's all just a series of incremental scenes because they get to the mansion house and they're like, hey, you ever meet anybody you haven't killed? And like, we're gonna kill this guy, and then he falls in the pool. That pool scene to me was terrifying because it's like, oh, we had a pool with a pool cover on it, and it was like basically my job as a kid to take care of the pool. Like, you want the pool, you take care of it. So I was the one who knew how to clean out the diatomaceous earth and pump the pump and get under and handle the corroded electric wires and also pull the covers and clean the pool. So that could have happened to me. I could have drowned in that pool cover. Once again, I'm thanking 80s movies for my current neuroses. But then you get back to good family scenes as well. You know, the daughter jumps in Roger Murtaugh's arms and says, I'm glad you're home at a sensible hour.
I'm glad you're home at a sensible hour.
Well, I try to be a sensible dad.
You're very cute. And they have a dinner. And there's a dinner wrap. That friggin' wrap is awesome.
My name is Carrie. I'm no fairy. My sister's Sherry. She's in love with this guy named
Carrie.
Nicholas.
Come on.
We cut to them being buddy-buddy, drinking on boats. That's something that's going to persist throughout the series. You know anything about boats? I know how much they cost. And then we get to the gun range scene, which is, once again, back to Shane Black being an excellent screenwriter. What a great place to have some serious dialogue take place, like peppered between shooting. It's like, you're definitely paying attention. It's a unique setting. I think Shane Black does that well. It's like, how do we put these guys in unique settings just to further the exposition? You know, a lot of movies would have people sitting down at a bar, having coffee.
Yeah, then again, how do they hear each other? I mean, they're shooting and they got ear muffs. What do they call those? Noise canceling headsets.
It's called ear protection. But if you go to a gun club, you just say eyes and ears, and they know that you need to rent goggles and ear protection.
How do they hear each other? How is that a dialogue? I don't know. I was thinking that instead of like listening to their dialogue.
But it's still a great scene. And then you learn a little bit more about Martin. You learn a little bit more about Danny Glover, and they head over to Dixie's house. And I was looking at that movie and I'm like, so the kids drawing in chalk on the sidewalk. I was like, are these the four kids from Boys in the Hood? Just So those kids are funny, and they use this is something that the screenplay and the series does well as well, is that it continues to use other day player characters to help further along the narrative in an interesting way. The stuff that the kids are talking about ends up gives the characters a chance to play off them, and we get to see the dimensionality of our main characters.
Right. So that's pretty sweet when they have the conversation with the kids. I thought it was great screenwriting because it brings in the kids that say hilarious things, and like, he's trying to work with them. And they're still trying to find the bad guys. And so we're like, can we give you some crayons? Can you draw the person? And that's a sweet moment when the kid sees Riggs has a tattoo. And he says, oh, the bad guy had that. Riggs has to explain that. That special forces, that means he's like me, but a bad guy. So that's a sweet little setup where it's a cute scene with kids, but also really kind of establishes who these bad guys are and how there's going to probably be a confrontation between those two.
We talked in Beverly Hills Cop about the actuality of the crime and the crime investigation that takes place in these movies and how it's not that complex. In Beverly Hills Cop, it's like Eddie Murphy showed up at the warehouse, found there was bearer bonds in the art stuff and that there was drugs. And like, that was it. Like, he had figured it all out just by visiting this warehouse twice. And in Lethal Weapon, the crime is not that complex either. There's this guy, he's laundering money for his ex-Vietnam buddies and they were special forces. We kind of all figured that out in like three easy steps. It's like those 80s movies didn't have this crazy whodunit. It's not your caper film, like a Rian Johnson Knives Out type of film where like you got to figure out who done it. it.
Just want to say, as cool as Dixie's house blowing up is, and how cinematic that is,
pretty cool.
In terms of like the characters and the narrative and the investigation, Murtaugh was ready to close the case. Case closed. It was probably that guy at the pool. He was ready to say it's all over, but we, I suppose, talked to Dixie.
This is still his first day with his new partner. He wants to get away from him.
I just want to point out that Dixie's place, I mean, the blowing up was cinematic and stupid. Apparently, Mr. Joshua was super recognizable. The kids could even give basic details about him. The blow-up switch was very, you know, something that was that also gave a huge clue to who was responsible. So it's way to go, bad guys. I mean, you totally made it easier for Riggs and Murtaugh.
Yeah.
There is that one scene where Murtaugh's on the bridge. I guess there's an early version of a cell phone. And he's talking to Mary Ellen Traynor, a police psychologist, who something else you see in the 80s movies that isn't very common in movies that I think happen now, but the police psychologist, he's very loudly with Riggs behind him, very loudly saying, this guy's way too unstable. I can't work with this guy. But I thought it was pretty funny.
That was a very early look at cell phones in films. Cell phone, mobile phone technology completely changed the plot to movies. You can't have French Connection in a world where cell phones exist, because that movie was just going to a series of payphones and stakeouts, people being withheld information because they didn't have access to calling somebody. Cell phones forever changed movie plots, unless you go back and write before that time. But we used to have this bag phone, and I would sneak it in my backpack into high school. We would go to the library. We would use it to call each other out of class. But we would call the principal's office and be like, yo, Joe Friend needs to come out of school, or so-and-so needs to go out of school. And we'd actually be calling from inside the school. Anyway, moving along.
Hey, Joe, did you bring your bag lunch? No, but I brought my bag phone. I think we're getting past the midpoint. There's this one moment that kicks off the third act.
You better nail the midpoint, because it's super obvious.
Oh, okay. Well, I think the scene when Murtaugh's talking to Hunsaker and Hunsaker gets shot, I feel that's pretty close to midpoint, because that kicks off the scene that kicks off eventually ending with the kickoff to the act three.
Okay, so the helicopter sniper scene is definitely the climax of act two. But the midpoint is...
the penultimate climax of act two. I think the desert scene is the actual...
Hang on. The midpoint of act two is the shotgun assassination on Martin Riggs.
Oh.
It changes the perspective of the bad guys. They think he was alive. Now they think he's dead.
Bullshit. We got the edge, Cochise.
Edge?
Roger. They think I'm dead. I'm a corpse.
So that, to me, that's very obviously the midpoint. But then it kicks off the second half of Act Two, which is just now a series of action sequences. We have the shotgun assassination window scene, which is an awesome stunt. You know, you have Mr. Joshua. He's a really solid movie bad guy, because he plays it straight. He plays it like a highly trained but subservient military guy. He's almost like optimistic voice. Like, oh yeah, I killed the guy, but there was a prop that's completely cool. But then you get to the desert driving helicopter arrival. So from film locations and like a stunt sequence, that whole scene where like pickup truck and the limousine and the helicopter are flying and driving in a straight line, just low to the ground. That was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, unnecessary, but cool looking, which is happens a lot in this movie. And speaking of which, that one sniper scene, I just want to take a moment to have a few quibbles about that. When I was younger, that was badass. Hunsaker gets shot. The bullet goes right through his eggnog carton. Why is his eggnog carton perfectly coming out with this hole like that? Back in the day, I thought that was super freaking cool. But then as I watched it again, it's fairly clearly a setup stunt, because he's holding his eggnog. He wasn't holding it before, but when he gets shot, he's very much holding it in a weird way in front of his chest. So there's that. And also, Riggs is outside. Riggs is outside the whole time, right next to the cliff where the helicopter shows up. So he never heard the helicopter approaching at any point. And he just kind of, if it suddenly appeared when Mr. Joshua was ready to shoot, and at no time did he hear it.
Malibu's got all those nooks and crannies, and all your neighbors have helicopters.
Still.
The place is lousy with helicopters, I think. But to your point, folks said that shot is an homage to the Manchurian Candidate, where the president gets shot through a carton of milk. But yeah, I see what you mean.
So yeah, that's a hell of a sound buffering for a helicopter to disappear like that. And then Riggs, the sharpshooter, he's a guy that can do only something that one in a billion can do, is have perfect shooting. We definitely see that during the target range scene. But so this, not only does the helicopter appear and get off a perfect shot to Hunsaker, but it flies away without Riggs even having even just one bullet. Not even a single bullet gets it to the helicopter in all that time.
I don't know. I think there would be some handgun marksmen who would take umbrage to your quibble, because it's really difficult to hit something with the handgun. It's a short barrel. It's not meant for long engagements of more than 100 yards at most. You know, in a controlled environment like a shooting range where you're a marksman and you know your weapon well, great. When a helicopter's flying away and it's outside and it's windy, windy. You're over the ocean. I don't think he would have been able to hit
Riggs anything. Should have known that if he's such a marksman. Right?
Just like Johnny Utah should have known not to fire his gun 27 times into the air after he fell on his back, because those bullets come down.
So Riggs is just frustrated.
That's an 80s trope frustration that we get to see play out time and time again. But getting back to the desert scene, you know, the location is actually, the location is El Mirage Dry Lake Bed. I had the privilege of being out there a few weeks ago, and we were filming a music video, songs that are coming out. And it's really cool. It's this really empty, open lake bed that you can just pay the fee to get into the park and then just drive onto this thing, and you basically have carte blanche to drive around willy-nilly. Do whatever you want. We could have done donuts the whole time. We're in a pickup truck. It's not wise to do donuts in a pickup truck.
But are those videos available to the listening audience?
Yes. By the time of this release, they will be. And we'll backfill this on our website, stumpthestump.com. Actually, we'll dub in what the website's going to be. www.filmpodcast.net. That's right, folks. www.filmpodcast.net. The umbrage I have to this scene, though, is that we have this cool setup. We got Martin Riggs, who's actually, we find out, was a Vietnam sniper who was sent in to do assassination work. He gets snuck up on by the general, like the flimsiest bad guy that there is. I don't like that this happened. You shouldn't have dined Riggs out like that. Have someone else get him.
Yeah, it was just too easy. And Mr. Joshua, like, all of a sudden knows. He's like, oh, it must be Riggs just by how the bullets are hitting, whatever.
Yeah, we're rolling through the second half of Act Two. We get a bunch of cool scenes here. We get that whole lake bed scene is excellent from beginning to end. You get to see Danny Glover's finest acting chops come out. You feel for him. Rhiannon, I don't know. I just don't like that they have people do dumb stuff, and she does a lot of dumb stuff and has to take directions. Like in screenplays, we've gotten away from that where, you know, we have our characters be a little more capable than that instead of just having them take direction in the way that they do. But excellent scenes there.
Yeah, you're right. She totally could have gotten away from that helicopter, in my opinion. So that's where I think Act 3 gets kicked off. At that moment, that's when they basically have all three. They have the daughter, they have Riggs, and they have Murtaugh. Flimsy reasons for why they need Murtaugh. I guess it's because they want to hear him talk about who else might know about the project, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
But either way,
Mr. Joshua believes in being thorough.
That's right.
I agree with you. That is literally the cleaving point, because you cut to Martin Riggs, shirtless.
So you managed to get your shirt off.
Hanging from a hook, the hands of everyone's favorite henchman.
Endo.
Al Young.
Endo, meet Mr. Martin Riggs.
Endo here has forgotten more about dispensing pain than you and I will ever know.
Terrific.
Yeah, he's got a car battery. He's got a little portable car battery that he does his lethal zappy zaps with. I'm not sure a car battery is enough to do what it does to Rig, but either way, it's cinematic, and it's a troubling scene because there's so much water around, and you're just wondering how Rig's going to get away from all this.
So our season two live action show outside of Comic-Con in San Diego will be a live demonstration of the car battery trick. I will be administering it to Brian, who doesn't believe it'll do anything. So we're going to find out. Stay tuned.
You can do it just by going to your car. Go to your car right now and put your finger on the positive and negative. Tell me what happened.
No, I want to put a wet sponge on you.
Oh, okay. That'll make all the difference.
To just the car battery directly and see what happens. There's a lot of middleware between you and the car.
You know what, Joe Friend? You can ghost spit, which is what Murtaugh keeps saying as he is getting his own little kind of interrogation torture.
Dick Jones. So at this point, we learn that Rhiannon's going to need some therapy in life. Body's falling all over at this point, and she's just not going to... She's going to have trust issues. She'll probably have old man issues for a while. So she's going to have a fun time. And then they escape, and they go through the nightclub, which is like, nightclub's all right. But then we get out to an awesome scene on Hollywood Boulevard itself. This is great. Great locations. Hollywood Boulevard, you're right smack in the middle of it.
Let's not shortchange that whole way Riggs gets out of the situation. I mean, that's key. That's how it all gets kicked off. From the very beginning, we're told that Riggs is a lethal weapon. Supposedly, it's because he knows karate and jiu-jitsu and capoeira. I don't know. Whatever. But he knows some sort of martial arts, which we never see until the climax, and then in his way of dispatching Endo, which is this little leggy, neck-snappy thing. And then Riggs comes in, guns a-blazing. And that's right. That's a really sweet scene. I mean, first of all, McAllister and Mr. Joshua just turn into wusses and they just run. They're like, oh no, Riggs is loose. Let's get out of here. And they just dash off, both of them. Yeah, and there's that sweet scene where Riggs is like just running through the highway. Is it Hollywood Boulevard?
Well, it's Hollywood Boulevard, but then they get out to the highway as Mr. Joshua takes an on-ramp onto, I don't know what highway it would be, so the 405 or the 101.
I skipped Wilshire and took Beverly over to Santa Monica and took that all the way up.
But yeah, so the general gets... his death at the hands of Danny Glover, proving that he is still an expert shot when he handily dispatches his driver. And then that general car rolls over and he happens to have a car full of grenades.
Oh my God.
Lesson learned.
Kill that cop, son of a bitch.
No way you live, no way.
But I didn't give a shit that General McAllister died that way because, again, he was just, he's a lackluster bad guy. I wasn't scared of him. I didn't see why people looked up to him. Mr. Joshua, though, psychopath.
McAllister, everyone, he kind of bragged that everyone's super loyal to him. I didn't see why. I guess maybe because of the military background, the Shadow Company, they just kind of take orders and it's chain of command or whatever. But the prevalence of grenades in this movie, I'm not sure how... I don't know if that's something that's pretty common to, you know, beat cops, is they just happen to have a hand grenade just in case they're just an interrogation little desert.
Hey, man, all these guys were freshly back from Nam, you know, the previous decade. So,
oh, they just kind of brought assuming some souvenirs.
They had an ammo box or a duffel bag full of live, slowly aging grenades that probably shouldn't have. To be fair, they're still finding like World War II munitions under London when they do digs and stuff. So,
you're a bad screenwriter apologist, and that's why you're my friend.
Oh, yeah, I've had to apologize for a lot of your work. Speaking of apologist behavior, then we get to the very ending, Brian, mm-hmm. where there is the most baffling bit of action mm-hmm. that is not police procedure. But here's the part we're going to tell me, well, it wouldn't be a great movie if they just arrested the dude.
Yeah, I mean, if he's a lethal weapon, they got to prove it. And like I said, it was leading up to this moment where this confrontation between Joshua and Riggs, and it's definitely not procedure, and Murtaugh is definitely an enabler, but he's like, go get him, Riggs. How is it raining? Is it, did someone hit a fire hydrant, or is it just suddenly raining in LA during this whole scene?
It's a fire hydrant. Mr. Joshua goes up to the two cops that are stationed outside who think nothing of a random guy coming up to him and being like, oh
yeah,
we're here to guard this house against mercenaries, so we'll just hang out and be happy talking to strangers.
Excuse me, sir. May we help you?
No, thank you.
So those cops get killed. Their police cruiser rolls over a fire hydrant, and then we set the stage for, you know, that house has been used many, many times in different settings. So the Murtaugh's house, it's on the Warner Brothers Ranch. It has the fountain from Friends. It was part of the Columbia Studios lot. It was used on The Partridge Family. There was a couple other things it was used for. I think that had something to do with Christmas Vacation as well, but I got to look that up again. So anyway, yeah, the fight scene.
Here goes jiu-jitsu and capoeira and I don't know. Doesn't take much. And again, knowing what we know now about Gary Busey and I guess Mel Gibson, it's an interesting to see these guys getting into fisticuffs as the big climax of this movie. I never thought of Gary Busey as being any kind of a threat. But yeah, that's the big fight. And then it ends with Riggs and Murtaugh in a lover's embrace. What happens? I mean, is there anything else that kind of happens? Is there like a final I think Mr. Joshua isn't quite
Mr.
dead.
Mr. Joshua is able to secure the handgun of a foot patrolman.
Yeah.
And enabling then Danny Glover and Mel Gibson to simultaneously shoot him. And that's the last of our 80s tropes, the double shooting.
Yeah, I know. To bring it all kind of full circle, not only is it very Die Hard-esque where, you know, the ballet dancer from Die Hard, I forget his name.
Alexander Goodenough.
Not only does he appear out of nowhere.
Say his name.
Good enough. Yes, he is good enough. And then he shows up and he grabs a gun and he shoots at them. And also a little intersection is the Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
That also ends with a double shooting between Ronnie Cox.
Yeah, Lieutenant Bogomil and Axel Foley, dispatch of Victor Maitland at the end.
It's one of the sweetest endings. I do have to tip my hat to all the things that come together in this very last moment. First of all, there is a bullet gift from Riggs to Murtaugh, which is a nice touch because this is Riggs shows him somewhere near the kickoff of Act Two. He shows him the mm-hmm. bullet that he intends to kill himself with. And at the very end, Riggs gives Murtaugh the bullet, which is like a little gracefulness thing. Hey, you know, I used to be this way, but now I'm no longer. And it's because of our sweet partnership.
I owe it all to you.
A sweet little bro moment.
Looks like we both the fucked.
Also super sweet, which is super smart for a screenwriter, is Riggs' dog makes an appearance. You know, everyone loves a dog. And we get an intro. Actually, it's a kind of an introduction.
Donald Trump doesn't love dogs. That's
yeah. So this isn't a movie for Donald Trump, but Riggs' dog is there, and Riggs is like, "Hey, can my dog come in?" And everyone's like, "Yeah, I miss Sam from way at the beginning." And it's the meet cute between Burbank the cat and Riggs the dog. We don't quite see that, but I think we hear some cat yelling. And the, So that's sweet. And lastly, a sweet moment is it is Christmas. And after they've kind of said their final, like, I love you, man, or whatever, Riggs goes inside and his loving family, Murtaugh's family, is there to, like, fully embrace him. Murtaugh notices finally that there is a Christmas light bulb right above him that's not quite screwed in. And he takes care of that, screws it in tight. Sweet grace note. I love that. I love how all those things come together like that at the end. That's a perfect ending.
The excellent encapsulation, because they also pull back and you get to see the house is damaged. And that's been a hallmark of the series as well. Mm-hmm. They always find a way to fucking blow up the house or do something to the house. That's always fun. This is probably one of my favorite series. You know, if you consider Star Wars and Indiana Jones and just all the other series that we've been treated to over the years, I think Lethal Weapon is my favorite, simply because it's got the perfect blend of action, the perfect heartwarming setup of characters, a lot of great comedy. You just feel close to these characters by the end of the film and then throughout the remainder of the series. So you're kind of stumping for them. You know it's going to be an action movie with heart. So as usual, the must-see movies on our list are all must-see. So go see this one if you haven't seen it, or watch it again every year like we do.
My final thoughts is congrats to Shane Black for being an inspiration for so many screenwriters. This one is a good movie to help screenwriters take the plunge. Upon our viewing, it's like, what was it that really captured the fascination of producers? And maybe it's more to do with the first draft that he did, but I think you see little elements that he really kind of brings to the fore more in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I think is that's one of my favorite movies just for writing in general. I love how he ends it where he talks Robert Downey Jr. talks directly to the audience and he says, and to the good people of the Midwest, sorry for all the effort.
All right, so thank you for joining us today, and that's all I got to say.
Well, that's clearly one of us getting too old for this shit, but this is Brian Stump saying I'll see you at the next podcast, hopefully next season, where we're going to need a bigger boat. Another hint to the theme of next season. And signing off, Brian Stump saying we'll fix it in post.
And this is Joe Friend saying I'll be the one who gets to fix it in post. Want to learn more? Navigate over to www.filmpodcast.us or follow us on Facebook or follow us on Instagram
or follow us in a primered unmarked van.
Just follow us, goddammit.
Wondering how Brian Stump got from published film professor to award-winning screenwriter filmmaker to co-host of Film Podcast with Brian and Joe? Brian's book, Movie Malcontent, is available in both paperback and Kindle. Simply use the search terms Movie Malcontent Stump. You'll laugh. You'll learn. You'll love Brian's incisive movie reviews, filmmaker interviews, and Film Fest journals. So bye.
Hey, Joe, might you be able to recommend any graphic novels?
Funny you should ask. The Robot War, a limited series sci-fi action comedy graphic novel written by yours truly. Santa Barbara is under siege by a robot army in a devastating attack. A ragtag group of video game designers, led by a cocky wiseass, battle across town to rescue his girlfriend and a school full of trapped children. You can get The Robot War on Amazon or through Comixology. That's The Robot War by Joe Friend.
Think you're brave enough to read what industry insiders are calling one of the most terrifying screenplays they've ever read? The Making of Merciless by Brian Stumpf in paperback is just $9.99 on Amazon. Simply use the search terms Making Stumpf Merciless. This twisty, clever, award-winning, 5-star rated horror about a film crew in the deep woods awakening a demon is flying off the shelves at Amazon.